ID, the Future, a podcast about evolution and intelligent design.
Welcome to ID, the Future. Today, I'm pleased to be joined again by Dr. Brian Miller to talk about the detailed course on abiogenesis by Dr. James Tuer, distinguished synthetic organic chemist at Rice University. Welcome back, Brian.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, Brian, for any listeners who might be joining us for the first time, just give us a quick summary of what the abiogenesis course is that Dr. Tuer was doing and why he put this together for us.
Sure. And it was the course he put together was motivated by a video done by David Farina, also known as Professor Dave, where this YouTube personality critiqued James Tuer's critique of the origin of life research, where it stands. So there are so many errors in that video that James Tuer wanted to create a detailed series on the origin of life to show where origin of life research truly is. What are the challenges they're facing? Why they haven't seemed to make any progress in the last 65, 70 years? And he simply wanted to bring greater clarity and understanding of the actual science.
And last time we talked about the fact that getting the building blocks of life is not easy, even in a lab today with all of our technology and all of our protocols and all of our capabilities, much less on the early Earth. And further, even if you did get some of the building blocks, it's difficult to get those organized in the right way that moves toward life. And finally, we talked about the difficulty of time and the fact that more time, as people often say, well, it was millions of years or whatever time frame they put on it. Time is actually not helpful. As you mentioned last time, time is the enemy rather than helping in the process because these molecules break down. So let's talk a little bit more today about how we can bring all of these cellular components together. What did Dr. Tuer stress there?
Well, he stressed how this stage is as complicated or even more difficult than other stages. And he used a beautiful analogy. He talked about imagining that you have parts of a car that are entirely separated. And then also further imagine they're scattered throughout the Earth. And the difficulty of a cell coalescing is analogous to someone who has no understanding of transportation vehicles, no technical expertise, trying to find all these parts and assemble them in a functional car if he has no manual, he has no tools, and he has no machine shop. So that's just sort of a beautiful example of the difficulty of this. And Dr. Tuer makes the point that the challenge of, even if you have all the building blocks of life, even if you have them in a local area, the challenge is bringing them together into a functional cell is enormously complex that we're nowhere near achieving, even in a laboratory.
Yeah. Yeah. And just to press on that example a little bit, it's not just that it's all spread about and the parts have to be assembled by somebody that doesn't know what they're doing. If we wanted to press the analogy a little bit, we'd say it's somebody who not only doesn't know what they're doing, but doesn't care and has no interest in it and has no tendency to put these things together. And one of the things that Dr. Tuer, I don't remember if it was in this video series or in another lecture I heard, you know, he said, molecules don't care about life. They're not driving toward making life. That's not what they do. So it's a really difficult problem where we try to do an analogy to somebody building something, but it's actually much worse than that.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It'd be more like a chimpanzee with deep emotional issues and violence tendencies trying to put together these parts.
There you go. So Dr. Tuer talked about something called the Leventhal paradox of the interactome. That's quite a mouthful. Tell us what that means for our listeners.
Sure. And the Leventhal paradox was a term that was first used in protein studies, where if you have, let's say, a long chain of amino acids in a protein, it would be able to interact and fold in vast numbers of ways. So the question is, how does it actually fold into a real protein that's useful? And this basic idea was expanded to the idea of an entire cell. And it's called the Leventhal paradox of the interactome. And it's described in a paper by Tompa and Rose, who are biologists. And the basic challenge is that if you look at the number of ways that biological molecules can link together, it's truly astronomical. So they looked at the number of proteins in like an E. coli cell and asked how many ways can these proteins link to each other? And the number is something like 10 to the power of 79 billion just for a yeast cell. Now, if you imagine, let's say, a minimally complex cell, that might be more like 10 to the power of a billion, but it's still an astronomically large number. That's a one with a billion zeros. And just as for comparison, the number of atoms in the visible universe is a one with 80 zeros. And the challenge is that the number of interactions of these proteins that are useful for life divided by the total number possible is fantastically small. It's unimaginably small. So there's no way purely by chance that these proteins will come together to form a functional cell, even if they were all there. And one point that the researchers made was that if you have a cell and it dies and it starts to break apart, you'll never be able to put it back together again. Because as soon as it starts to decompose, that's an irreversible trajectory. So the only way to have life is for life to create life using the sophisticated machinery that it's endowed with.
Right, right. And just to clarify, was that research for E. coli or a yeast cell that they did?
I'm sorry, it was for a yeast cell. But if you imagine using not E. coli, but like a minimally complex bacteria, then the numbers drop from like maybe 10 to a power of 79 billion to 10 to a billion. So I was making that comparison.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, and this point that the odds of getting these pulled together and the time frame that would be required to even make these odds reasonable, which is way beyond the time frame of our universe. And then on the other side of the equation, you have this degrading situation where these things are breaking down. And there's just absolutely no way, as you mentioned, that these things come together before they break down. They're breaking down way faster than they could ever interact in the proper way.
And that's something that people don't fully appreciate very often, is that people say maybe with more time, the cell can slowly build itself up. Mm-hmm. But the problem is, as you move a chemical system away from equilibrium, in other words, the more the concentrations are different from the surroundings, the more you create larger molecules like proteins, the more physical processes are trying to break it back down to simple chemicals. So that's why even if you have a protocell that's, let's say, just at a few stages away from basic chemicals towards life, if you don't do anything, it's going to break apart and turn back into simple chemicals. So cells have to constantly use energy to maintain their order because natural processes are trying to break them apart. So what happens is all physical processes move in a direction that's the exact opposite of what's necessary to get to life. So not only is it fantastically improbable, but that journey from simple chemicals to life, you're having to move against all the processes of nature, what they want to do. That's the big challenge.
Yeah, and this brings up a really fundamental point, Brian, both for origin of life and evolution generally, which I think is really important to underscore. And that is that the story about how these things came about, whether you're looking at origin of life or later evolution, relies upon processes that we know living systems are fighting hard to overcome. There are, if you're talking about DNA, there's error correction mechanisms. There's all these kinds of things that are actively trying to prevent the very thing that is part of the story of how this came about under the naturalistic scenario. And if you're talking about origin of life, as you mentioned, there are processes in the cell that are actively working to prevent this breakdown, which otherwise is just going to happen. And so it's not just that, we don't quite have it worked out. It's not quite figured out. We've got to add a little more effort to it. It's working at exact cross purposes to the way things have to be in order for life to work.
Yeah, that's a terrific point. And that's something that's hard to appreciate because people will see that the technology in life looks a lot like human technology. But they'll say, well, the cell's different. So maybe it's easier for life than for us to create, let's say, a rotary motor. The challenge is it's much harder because when you get to these very small length scales, the thermal fluctuations become much more disruptive. So it's kind of like if you're trying to build a house in the middle of a hailstorm where the hail is the size of golf balls. You're constantly, everything you try to do is being ripped apart by natural processes. So that's why it's so hard for us to create these molecular machines, let alone life.
Yeah, like you're talking about Brownian motion and the impacts in that situation that you're mentioning, the golf balls, right?
Yeah, like Brownian motion is going to bounce water molecules or other molecules in the cell against cellular structures, always disrupting them, always causing damage.
So what other topics did Dr. Tour address in his series? I know we already talked a lot about degradation and breaking apart, but tell us about homochirality.
Yeah, well, one of the big challenges of origin of life research is that when you look at these synthesis experiments in a lab, what you always will see as at each step, you don't simply have the intermediate that you want, the intermediate that would help you move towards, let's say, a nucleotide or a sugar necessary for a cell membrane, but you get lots of other molecules that are very, very similar. they might have the same atoms, but they might be slightly mismatched in different ways. So the question becomes, how do you actually separate what you want from what you don't need, which would be destructive? And the most difficult part is you have chirality in molecules. That means that if you have a molecule that looks like your right hand, you'll also have a molecule that looks like your left hand. They'll be mirror images. And mirror image molecules are indistinguishable in terms of their chemistry, in terms of their physical properties. So how do you separate, let's say, a left-handed amino acid from a right-handed amino acid? That's an incredibly difficult process. And even with our most sophisticated lab techniques, we can only do that a little bit. So there are experiments where you can use a homochiral sugar or amino acid with a particular handedness. You'll use it to crystallize another amino acid. And even with these very sophisticated techniques, starting with homochiral chemicals, which means only one-handedness, you're only able to get an excess of maybe 20-some percent, an excess of one particular image of that molecule. And the problem is life needs 100% excess. Life only needs left-handed amino acids or right-handed sugars. So how that happened on an early Earth when we can't do it in our laboratory is an enormous problem.
Yeah, and there's an incredibly naive, and this came out in Farina's video as well, there's an incredibly naive idea that it doesn't really matter. We can start with a mixed bag and then life will separate it out later through selection or something. Or maybe it just doesn't matter at all, people might say. You know, yeah, we've got left-handed, but it doesn't matter. It could have been just as well with right-handed. I think Tuer talked a little bit to that as well, didn't he?
Yeah, so this idea that, well, maybe these proteins or these the RNA wasn't perfectly homochiral. It didn't just have either right-handed sugars or left-handed amino acids. But the problem is, when you look at people studying this issue, they realize that for an enzyme to function, it has to fold in the right way. For a protein to be useful, you have to have left-handed amino acids, because if you mix in, let's say, 10% of right-handed, then you're not going to get, let's say, the helical structures or the beta sheets or the structures you need to enable the right three-dimensional shape to drive the right chemistry. Mm-hmm. In RNAs, if you have a mixture of, let's say, left-handed nucleotides, that's going to create enormous problems in how they function in a cell. So that's a very naive understanding of the problem.
Yeah, you can't just put a left-handed glove on your right hand and have it fit very well.
Yeah.
So this is great. We've got a lot of good criticisms that Dr. Tuer put out about the video that Dave Farina produced. Maybe this is just Dave Farina's misconceptions. Are some of these misconceptions widespread among the public?
They're extremely widespread. Like Dr. Tuer in his video mentioned a particular survey. And what happened was in the survey, 72% of the people surveyed believed that people had created simple life in a laboratory, like a bacteria. So people have this impression that this is really a solved problem or very close to being solved. What's even more extraordinary is a survey said that like 41% of people believe that we created complex animals in laboratories like frogs. And then also, if you look at textbooks are just filled with misconceptions about the state of the research. Like they'll say the RNA world is a viable model for the origin of life, despite the fact that RNA didn't exist on the early Earth, despite all the problems with replication. They'll talk about, let's say, how the prebiotic soup is a viable explanation for the building blocks of life. But again, if you go to the experiments, what happens, any Miller-Urey-type experiment may produce some trace quantities of some of the amino acids and maybe a little bit more of glycine or something. It's always mixed in a mixture with lots of other stuff. So that would end the origin of life story. So the misconceptions are pervasive about this field.
Yeah, I remember this survey. I was struck by that as well. I did a little write-up for Evolution News on that because it was so remarkable that a lot of people have this impression. And, you know, when you see some of the hype that Dr. Tuer also mentioned in one of his videos that he focused on this point, is some of the hype that is not just in the news stories, but also even in the papers coming out in the origin of life field. It's really disappointing, and it's certainly understandable how people are misled in this topic. So what is Dr. Tuer hoping to see change about how origin of life research is conducted and presented to the public?
Well, first, he wants people to stop this research that's completely irrelevant to the question. Like, if you have a laboratory that can synthesize, let's say, a building block of a nucleotide through an incredibly sophisticated protocol, that's really interesting research, but it has nothing to do with the origin of life. So he wishes for people to be aware that that is just not relevant and not to fund that type of research because it's meaningless. He also wishes the Origin of Life community to focus on the really foundational issues that are relevant to the origin of life. Things like, how do you deal with the isolation of the relevant compounds that you need? Like, focus on how that might work. Mm-hmm. He wants them to focus on what's called the mass transfer problem. And that's the problem that if you start with, let's say, some chemicals, and that chemicals runs through a protocol of multiple steps, at the end of that protocol, you'll have such a small amount of a certain intermediate that you can't go forward. So the problem is, where do you get all the mass that you need from the beginning, at the beginning stage? You can't go back and order more from your chemical store.
So yeah, and this relates also, Brian, you had talked about earlier, this relay synthesis issue,
yeah,
which is very important in the sense that researchers are able to get the purity and the homochirality that they need, but also the volume. They can go back and buy as much as they want rather than carrying it forward from the results of reaction A to reaction B.
That's exactly right. In fact, if you get to the 10th step, the only way you could have gotten that intermediate at the 10th step is if at the first step you had an amount of chemicals that's like equivalent to the mass of our planet in many cases. So again, that's a serious problem that they have to deal with.
And then also we have issues with information, right?
And that's a key point that James Tour is addressing, is none of the research on the origin of life is even dealing with this information problem. And now you do mm-hmm. have, let's say, self-replicating RNAs that people think maybe that's how you got the information, that you've got these RNAs that are mutating and replicating. But the problem is, when you look at all research on self-replicating molecules, even if you use, let's say, the machinery of life to make it happen, the molecules will always move in a direction where they're more efficient replicators. And that's it. Because let's say an RNA molecule that will fold into a useful shape to do something for the cell are selected against. Like, they're not something that can survive over time because they're harder to replicate because they're folded together. The ones that are going to dominate very quickly are the ones that don't do anything useful for life because all they do is self-replicate. So this issue of information hasn't been addressed, and it's very foundational.
So even if you had, and I want to make it very clear for listeners, as we talked in our last episode, that we don't have self-replicating RNA systems. But even if we had that, as you say, the tendency is to drive towards simplicity, not to drive toward a cell. You know, it's going to be jettisoning anything that's not absolutely necessary and driving towards simplicity instead of toward functional complexity. So that's great. And then lastly, this functional complexity, which has been used or described with this fancy term interactome, mm-hmm. which is kind of a difficult word, but basically just means the way that all of the various molecules in this cell can interact. What's the issue with that?
Right. And here's the problem. And I think the car analogy is apropos, because you can have all of the pieces of a car in your shop, but if you're just going to randomly connect these pieces together, you're never going to get a car, because there's far more ways to interconnect pieces that are useless than there are to interconnect pieces that produce something that'll drive you to work. In the same way, the number of ways that you can interconnect proteins and even the simplest cell is like on the order of 10 to the power of billions. And the percentage that correspond to a viable cell is fantastically small. So there's really no understanding of how you can connect proteins in ways that are not chemically preferred, but are necessary to meet engineering constraints. That issue isn't even really being discussed.
Well, this has been super, super great, Brian, to have you here. Just to wrap up, what's Tour's view on intelligent design? Did he address that in these videos? Or
No, Dr. Tour does not really address the issue of intelligent design. And for a very good reason, what he's decided to do is to operate entirely within the framework of the secular academy. So he's really working within the framework of scientific materialism. He's only talking about natural processes. He doesn't want people to dismiss him because he's not playing by their rules. So he's not even addressing the issue of design. He's just saying, even within the context of the rules of the secular academy, we're only going to talk about scientific processes that you can reproduce in a lab. Even by those rules, what's clear is that the origin of life research has made absolutely no progress towards understanding how a cell came together. Yet he was he interviewed me in a previous series, and he allowed me to answer the question of what is the positive evidence for design. And he also allowed me to explain how that framework actually helps to promote productive research. So that was very kind of him to allow me to present that aspect of the evidence.
Yeah, and that was great. And I encourage listeners to go look for that on YouTube as well, your interview with Dr. Tour. Well, Brian, thank you so much for being with us today to walk through some of the highlights of this detailed series on abiogenesis with Dr. Tour.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of ID the Future. To learn more about the origin of life and the evidence for design and purpose in nature, check out other episodes of ID the Future, as well as our YouTube channel, Discovery Science. If you find these discussions a valuable contribution to the public conversation about origins, consider sharing a link with a friend. For ID the Future, I'm Eric Anderson. Thanks for listening.
Visit us at idthefuture.com and intelligentdesign.org. This program is copyright Discovery Institute and recorded by its Center for Science and Culture.